WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. That's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth,
very
Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us, sir. How are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. My name is Kevin Tachi, and I will be your guide for nearly the next 2 hours of this radio program. I think what is best about this radio program is the variety of guests that we have. It isn't necessarily a show that is strictly based on politics. We don't sit and talk about one topic for the entire show. It's kind of broken up. I think it has worked going into 10 years of doing this particular format. We have joining us just to start out in the first hour, Plymouth County Commissioner Chair Greg Hanley. I fondly call this the county corner. You know, we got like the State House report when we have state representatives and state senators, the governor and lieutenant governor. But we feature in the county corner different officials who represent Plymouth County. It might be Bristol County, so that's why we kind of leave off what particular county it is in case we want to delve or go into that area. Greg's going to stop by and talk a little bit about what's going on with the county. Moving away from distributing the CARES Act funding that was under the Trump administration regarding COVID. Now we have ARPA, which is the American Rescue Plan Act put forth by the Biden administration. We'll talk about what the county is doing in regards to that funding or being involved with it. Following the commissioner chair, we will speak with Megan Driscoll Greenstein. She is the author of a wage transparency bill. If you're not sure at home, this is a House Bill number 1950 and Senate Bill 1208. And we're going to talk a little bit with her about her bill. This is, I believe it's being heard in a second session. It's actually been heard before the Labor and Workforce Development Committee. We'll find out how well it went when we talk to Megan in just a few minutes. Hour number two is going to be a fantastic ride. We start things out with Joe Rossi, Joe Flood, as we find out what's going on with the latest when it comes to flood insurance and the changes that could be coming, especially when it comes to the National Flood Insurance Program. Joe's the guy who's on the inside, one of the brightest minds when it comes to this particular type of insurance and when it comes to making sure that your home and your property is protected. We talk with Joe. And then, returning to the radio program, Junior D'Amato, the car doctor, will be joining us. Junior, who is a well-renowned not only for car sales today, it's outrageous what it costs for a used car now. If you want to sell your car, boy, you're going to reap the benefits. Also about the chip shortage and much more when Junior joins us. But right now, time for us to hit the pause button. And so we're going to find out one final time what's happening out on the roadways. Be brought to you on this end by Brennan Smoke Shop, online at BrennanSmokeShopMA.com. There are locations: Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, New Bedford, Weymouth, and now in Hudson, New Hampshire.
Well, thanks, Kevin. The expressway southbound's jam from Mass Ave to the on-ramp from Freeport Street. Then you're slow from Furnacebrook to the split. Northbound is busy from the Braintree split to Freeport Street. Route 3 south delays from the expressway to Union Street. Northbound's busy passing Derby Street. Route 24 south is sluggish from 93 to Route 139. This report is sponsored by Whole Foods Market. At Whole Foods Market, get 25% off sports nutrition protein powders and supplements through June 29th while supplies last. Plus, Prime members save an extra 10%. Learn more on the Whole Foods Market app. Traffic on the nines every morning. I'm Lisa DeMilo in the WATD Traffic Center.
Hey, it's Jeff from Brennan Smoke Shop. The best thing to light fireworks with is a fine cigar from Brennan Smoke Shop. See? You just touch the wick and there it goes. Oh, geez, the bottle fell over. Watch out! Watch out on the deck!
Nice job!
I probably shouldn't be doing this while holding a beer in one hand and a cigar in the other. Brennan Smoke Shop would like to wish you a safe 4th of July. Hey, it's Jeff from Brennan Smoke Shop, and I'm proud to be an American. You know why? Rights, freedoms, and liberties. I have the right to say how I feel. I have the freedom to say it on this radio station, and I have the liberty of saying it while enjoying this fine cigar from Brennan Smoke Shop. Cheers to rights, cheers to freedom, and a hip hip hooray for liberty. Happy birthday, America.
Brennan Smoke Shop, the best smoke shop in Massachusetts and soon New Hampshire.
Monday Night Talk continues all week long. Go to 95.9WATD.com/Monday Night Talk and keep in touch on Facebook and Twitter. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Joining us for a Plymouth County update. It's almost like it's the county corner. We actually have joining us the chairman of the Plymouth County Commissioners, Greg Hanley. Commissioner, how are you?
Good afternoon, Kevin. How are you today?
We're doing pretty good. Pretty good. I thought it was time to have you back on to talk a little bit about what's going on with the county, the latest with the county. And my understanding is there may be a new wrinkle in regards to some of the federal funding. I know that the Plymouth County was very proud in distributing CARES Act funding to the tune of over $90 million. And with the new administration coming in, we have the American, correct me if I'm here, American Rescue Plan Act?
Yes, sir.
That is in play. And I believe that Plymouth County is going to look to be a distributor or somehow involved when it comes to those funds. Is that correct?
You're spot on, Kevin, as usual.
So talk to us about the genesis. What was the conversation that, you know, that went from, hey, we worked our butts off, you know, distributing the CARES Act. This is, you know, COVID-related funding to help all 27 communities, one town, one city, 26 towns, make sure that each one of them get 100% of the monies that are given by the federal government. What was the conversation that that the county commissioners or the county wants to get involved with distributing ARPA funds?
Well, it goes really back to our success with CARES. If you think about it, back in April of 2020, the county applied for and received, as you said, $93 million of CARES Act money. We then distributed that money pretty evenly. We had a reimbursement program that we put on the street to our member communities. Monies were released in 7 tranches, and we facilitated all of the CARES Act criteria and eligibility through our member communities. And why we were able to do that is because before we made the decision to accept the funds, the governor made a plea to the county to say that they were better suited to distribute the money. And the one question we asked as commissioners, could he guarantee the money would come back to Plymouth County 100%. Now, keep in mind, we got $93 million. He got $112 million on behalf of the county. So we got 45%, he got 55% of money that was earmarked for the population of Plymouth County. And when the answer to the question is, would 100% of that money come back to the communities, he could not guarantee it. And then we knew it was our duty and our obligation to do the best we could for our member communities. So we embarked on a program of reimbursement. It was a program that the communities would go out on an a la carte menu of eligible expenditures, and they would have to spend the money. And then we would have to receive a warrant, a bill, and a check, and then we would give the money to them. Processing time, we were fantastic. We, to this day, have the lowest administrative cost for CARES in the country. Under 1%, it's actually 0.089 that we were singled out in a White House briefing as to the performance of CARES in Plymouth County. And so we're very proud of that record. And along the way, member communities, you know, were just overjoyed. And in fact, Kevin, you know the history of the county and how far it's come in the last 8 years. There was a lot of acrimony when I first got elected back in 2013. In fact, there was a charter commission question as to whether or not the county should continue because it was really in financial ruin. But with the leadership of Dan Pollard, the former chair, and Sandra Wright, myself, and of course, we wouldn't be able to do it without Tom O'Brien, who's the only certified county treasurer in the Commonwealth. We knew we had the intellectual property. We knew we had the relationships with our administrators, treasurers, and selectmen. And so we embarked on distributing the money. And as you know, I mean, it's probably going to get some sort of meritorious award. CARES Act expires in December of 2021. So the county has extended its program during that time as allowed by Congress and the president. So next comes APA, American Rescue Plan, as you pointed out. And that is a sophisticated program that is very, very intensive with respect to reporting and liability. There are 24 categories that of eligibility that member communities can apply for. And just to let you know, I'll break the news here that Plymouth County adopted APA on behalf of its member communities because, again, the question was posed of administration and finance under the Baker administration as to whether or not they could guarantee 100% of that money coming back, and they couldn't. And again, it was our duty and obligation to undertake it. Now, you would think that we are opposed to the governor. We are absolutely not opposed. We sought in the interim between CARES and APA, we sought and received $15 million of funding from the RAF program, which was a rental assistance for tenants program that we qualified for, received $15 million to distribute primarily to the denser populations. And then when we got it, we did our due diligence. We realized we were not best suited for the distribution of that money. And we called the governor up and we said, you know what, we'd like to give this money to you. And we turned it over to him and assigned our right to administer that program. So it's not all button heads, but you know, there's been a lot of attention given to us. And I can tell you on the state level, the Mass County Commissioners Association has now joined us with the County of Barnstable, County of Norfolk, and the County of Bristol all accepting the funds for APA. So they saw what money could be used for regionally. And in the APA program, remember when I told you that the state received a percentage of the money and then the county? Well, in this round of funding, the towns get direct funding from the federal government as if it was the state's apportioned share. So we're still dealing with the same ratios, but it's in reverse. We, as the recipient of funds, are eligible for $103 million. To distribute, and the member communities will get their own separate money. Their monies have to still qualify within the framework of APA, which water, sewer, broadband on the construction side, hazard pay, and then revenue replacement. Revenue replacement for cities and towns would be reductions in revenue related to taxation due to pandemic, hotel, motel tax, meals tax, any reductions there that over the course of COVID impacted the community, then they would be eligible to replace that revenue from that program. So right now we are in plan design. You'll expect a rollout of this program somewhere around September 1st. We've appointed in-house representation through the county treasurer's office. Tom O'Brien will be the lead on this. Jared Valenzuela, the freshman commissioner, is going to be our liaison to the program, to the member communities. And we're going to administer it in a safe, sound way and respect the process of CARES and the success of it and build off of it. The biggest thing being, Kevin, we need to be insulated from liability. And we're putting a program together which keeps waste, fraud, and abuse out of the equation. So it takes a long time to develop that program. And we've hired Koppelman and Page, KP Law. Forgive me for not remembering the accounting firm, but it's a big three accounting firm out of Boston. And Tom's going to be angry that I couldn't remember it. But then we'll have our auditing firm. So we're putting the team together. We're going to hit the road with the commissioners are going to start visiting the selectmen and explain to them what we're doing, and that's where we're going. So if you've got some questions, I'm more than glad to answer them for you.
What was it in new county commissioner Jared Valenzuela that I was thought that he be kind of an extension or part of this new distribution of ARPA funding, or at least be one of the key cogs in assisting with this program?
Yeah, first of all, I mean, he's a breath of fresh air. He's got a lot of energy. Actually, former chairman Pallotta says he reminds me of a young Greg Hanley. I said, oh, really? Is that letting the bull out of the barn, you know? But I don't know if that's a compliment or some other sleight of hand. But Jared has proven himself in 6 very short months of being adept at explaining things, and we think he's a very good communicator. He's intelligent, he gets it, and he's got the time to do it. I myself have to defer, because the county business as chair is a completely different job than it was when just being a member of the commission. And so under quote unquote my administration, commissioners are assigned projects. So in the case of Sandra Wright, she is dealing with the public safety aspect of the county, and that is pursuing items of public safety interest, i.e. a fire academy over on Long Pond Road. She has spearheaded the gun range project. We authorized a feasibility study, and that would provide an environmentally safe and affordable option for member community police departments to practice at a range. DEP has ruled that outdoor firing ranges are now illegal because the lead content that goes into the earth then leaches into the water supply. So we're working with Congressman Lynch to try to get some appropriation money under a couple of different baskets. And we're working with the state fire marshal on leasing property over in Bridgewater near the jail that, again, Commissioner Wright has championed. So bringing it back to Jared, he basically, this would be his very first, and it's not his very first, but it's an initiative of significance that needs someone who has the ability and the time to do it. So we're going to single him out as being our person on that. And I think he's up for the task, and he'll be under the guidance of the best treasurer in the Commonwealth.
As you're visiting, or the plan is to visit the different municipalities, the different boards of selectmen, select boards, city councils, town councils, whatever the governing board is, or committee, or the whoever the governance is in that said community, what are you feeling are going to be the facts, the frequently asked questions in regards to the ARPA money that maybe, you know, us having this conversation may lead to other conversations instead of the questions that you will hear as part of a redundancy from everybody?
Well, first of all, we don't have a crystal ball. We do feel as if we know our member communities. There were things that were allowed under CARES, not allowed under CARES, that are now currently allowed under APA. And that is going to be helpful. And that's issues like, for example, firefighters, police, and ambulance services that were going above and beyond the call of duty. There's hazard pay that's involved. There's even meritorious service for public servants who went above and beyond the call of duty. As you recall, most cities and towns' center of government was closed, but yet you had people manning the post beyond their 40 hours a week. You know, I mean, there were people that were kicking in 60 to 90 hours a week just so that they could have some sort of semblance of government and transactions. I can tell you my experience with CARES. We have very talented 27 communities when it comes to the administration of government. I mean, we have made great friends and learned of our colleagues in a way that when you're in the foxhole together trying to fight the battle and you come up with creative ways to solve the problem and to adhere to the rules and regulations of the funding, that's when the rubber meets the road. We anticipated a lot of backlash, Kevin, on this program because the Mass Municipal Association had put out information that the money should pass straight through to the member communities. And in Plymouth County, our communities were like, no. We're very happy with the county. We want to be insulated from liability. We want a check and a balance. We want to avoid fraud, waste, and abuse. And the problem is, Kevin, if in this round of funding with APA, there are penalty clauses for any kind of misuse. And so we were very cautious in our deliberations on whether or not we could do it, because although cities and towns can raise and appropriate taxes to solve mistakes and problems, the county can't. So right now we're in a stage where we believe we're going to help our communities the best we can. And the purpose of the tour is to solicit ideas from the selectmen, because primarily it's been administrators and treasurers under CARES. But, you know, this time around, we're allowed to do infrastructure projects, water, sewer, and broadband. And I don't think there's a community out there that couldn't use upgrades. So for me, if we were to adopt that program, I think it insulates us all, because in construction, you have to use Chapter 30B, which is the procurement law. It's construction law. And we would be the funding mechanism, and the rules of Chapter 30B would govern the projects in terms of construction, abeyance, and compliance. So that's probably the easiest route. But again, each community has different priorities, needs, and standards, and we're going on the road to get on as many agendas as we can to find out how can we help you.
We just got a couple of moments left in our conversation, and we've been speaking with Greg Hanley, chairman of the Plymouth County Commissioners. Anything you want to say in closing, whether it's about this new adventure, I don't know if you want to call it an adventure, but new opportunity to continue to receive, as you were saying at the tail end there, that, you know, your membership has confidence in you and keep growing that confidence in what the county can do. Anything you want to say in closing?
Well, again, it's partnership, right? It's collegiality. It's working together for a common cause. And we, for many years, were misunderstood, underutilized, and now we're given purpose because we have great leadership, great financial leadership, great leadership within our communities. And the team underneath the management is so supportive and so productive that, again, I think we're going to pull this off. And the beauty of it, Kevin, is now it's going to go to the County Commissions Association level, so there'll be uniformity in the program offering, and we hope to just help where we can. In the areas where we can't, we look to coordinate with the state in any way we can just to serve the public the best.
Well, we want to thank you again for joining us and talking about this latest development in regards to the American Rescue Plan Act and its it's being distributed via Plymouth County.
Well, thank you, Kevin. It's always a pleasure. And, you know, I kind of like the fact that you called it the Commissioner's Corner. I think we can get used to that. Although here in Makeup, I don't know, these Zoom things are working out, but we appreciate everything. And thank you. And I'll leave you with this, because Mr. Valenzuela, who, as you know, has a show on Tuesday nights at WATD, has a face for radio, and I have a face for Zoom. So we'll leave on that high note. Thank you, Kevin. Always a pleasure to be with you.
There he is, the one and only Greg Hanley. He is the chairman of the Plymouth County Commissioners. And again, you've been tuned into Monday Night Talk here at 95.9 WATD. We will step aside, albeit just for a moment. When we come back, more Monday Night Talk. Don't go anywhere.
If you want a drink, that's your business. If you want to stop, that's for Alcoholics Anonymous.
AA is an inclusive fellowship of individuals all around the world. The one thing you need to ask yourself is, am I ready to do something about my drinking problem? For more information, literature, and videos about Alcoholics Anonymous, and to find a meeting near you, call 617-426-9444 or visit AA.org.
Tiny of Tiny Sons Glass. If you're driving along right now and you've got an angry little ding in your windshield,
ouch!
But good news, we can fix that ding. We'll fix that ding before it spreads. Drive on over to Tiny and Sons, Route 53 Pembroke. We will fix that ding. Your insurance company will pay.
And that's why I sing, give me that ding.
So give me that ding. Tiny and Sons Glass will fix that ding. Insurance company will pay.
That's right.
My dad did a great job. 1-888-64-TINYS. Just call.
Give me that ding. That's nice.
Monday Night Talk continues all week long. Go to 95.9WATD.com/Monday Night Talk and keep in touch on Facebook and Twitter. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
There are usually many different times that we have reoccurring conversations here on Monday Night Talk. And this is yet another one of them. Joining us is good friend Megan Driscoll-Greenstein. And she is the godmother of the wage transparency bill. Maybe that's not the right title, but I'll take it. I wanted to put something because there's been a lot of groundwork that she has done, her and her team, and many people that she's been working with to put this forth. And there's been some exciting news over the past week, and she's here to talk with us about it. Welcome back, Megan.
Thanks so much for having me again.
So for folks who don't know what the wage transparency bill is, and you actually have bills, you have a House bill in 1950, and the Senate bill is 1208. Talk to us, what is the idea behind it?
So this is really a salary transparency bill, a salary range transparency bill. So the current pay equity law that was passed in 2016 and then enacted in 2018 basically stopped companies from asking for current pay in the process of hiring them. What they didn't realize, right, they couldn't know, is that that question was going to be very quickly replaced with what are your expectations? And so it's kind of a loaded question, if you will, right? Because you feel compelled to answer it, and yet you have no direction to go because you don't know what the salary pays. You know, you have no idea what the company's going to pay you. And so you often are, we find that women and men fall into male and female roles, and men are better at shooting for higher expectations than women are. And women are basing their expectations on their lower salary anyway. And so it's kind of like not a win-win for women in that way. The other thing that so we really wanted to address that issue. I was a recruiter, I owned one of the largest recruiting companies in the country. So when the pay equity law was put in place, we saw it on a massive scale. I mean, hundreds of companies managing their way through this and thousands of candidates. So we were seeing this play out over and over. So the candidates were kind of, the female and the minority candidates were kind of losing in that situation. But then the other part to this is that it was really hard for companies to manage not having somebody's base pay. Not only are expectations sort of a question that sometimes people don't answer, but oftentimes when you get those expectations, they can be inflated and unrealistic and not reliable. So even sometimes companies don't pay attention to it, and they move forward with candidates only to find out at the end, after they've interviewed them and brought them in and paid for all this stuff and wasted all their time, they make them an offer and the candidate's earning already more than what the salary pays. So pretty frustrating for companies to manage their way through it, and then not necessarily playing out in real time with the candidates because of the question being kind of replaced with what are your expectations. So this bill would specifically, it's sort of an amendment to the Equal Pay Act, but it would require companies to publish, to share the pay range with applicants upon request. And it would also require that companies share the pay range for women and for anybody in seats. So if I'm employed in a project manager role, I can ask my employer, what is the pay range for the job that I'm in? Which then further helps me sort of negotiate my salary further, right? Ask for raises. I have a hinge. I kind of understand where I sit in that sort of larger, broader organization. So that's the bill in a nutshell.
Okay. Now, this is the second legislative session or go-around for this bill. What happened previously? I think the easy answer is going to be COVID, but I'm sure that you'd be able to say that it did make it to a certain point, right?
Yeah. So we were a late file in the first session. So we had about 12 co-sponsors, and we did get to Labor and Workforce Development and were voted out unanimously. So we were in a really good place about this time last year. And then COVID hit, and pretty much every single piece of legislation that wasn't directly related to COVID relief was kind of put on the back burner, and everyone sort of had to re-engage the following year. Now, this year, because we had more time, we have secured a much broader support. I mean, so we have over 50 co-sponsoring legislators in both the Senate and the House. The bill was filed in both the House and the Senate this time, whereas last session it was just filed in the House. The two chairs of the Labor and Workforce Development Committee are co-sponsoring the bill, Senator Gehlen and Chair Cutler. We also have improved our business support. So we have the Chambers of Commerce of Quincy and Plymouth and Taunton and Springfield and Metro West and several others that have come on board to support this. We also have MassNow, the Mass Coalition, the Massachusetts Status and the Commission on the Status of Women. We have the Women's Bar Association. We have the Boston Women's Workforce Council. It kind of goes on and on. BECMA, Black Economic Council, Amplify Latinx. So this is a much broader coalition of organizations and companies that are sort of coming forward to say, this is a good bill. And the reason for it being, I think, and I'm excited about, not just sort of like socially promoted, right? But it's also backed by business, is because it really addresses a business need, right? There's a social need for wanting to close the gender wage gap in Massachusetts. But in addition, the existing pay equity law, right, caused some confusion with companies and made it a little bit difficult to manage their hiring. So this addresses some of those concerns for them.
So you had a dry run last legislative session, and you were successful going through the Labor and Workforce Development Committee. Were you nervous knowing that you were successful previously, or were you confident that you would be okay? And who joined you on the panel to discuss this this bill?
Yeah, so, I don't think I was necessarily nervous because, again, we're in a situation where we had already been pushed out unanimously last session. So I was feeling pretty good about it. And also, again, now Josh is the current chair of the Labor and Workforce Development Committee, which he wasn't the previous year. Really, it's what happens next that's most important, right? Like, it's early enough in the session where we can start to make progress throughout the House and the Senate and sort of figure out kind of where we're going to go, really kind of drive this forward. So there's a lot more work that needs to happen, even if we get voted, out unanimously from Labor and Workforce. But last week at the hearing, I was sort of joined by some amazing people. a woman named Stacey Vitale from the AAUW, Tim Cahill from the Quincy Chamber of Commerce, Katie Donovan, who was, she's just such an equal pay, guru, Karen Yee from the Association for Women in Science, Sam Jabru from the Black Economic Council, and Nina Kimball, who was actually representing the Commission on the Status of Women. Nina's also an employment lawyer and has been just key behind the scenes kind of working with me. And then we had this woman, Genevieve, come speak, and she talked about how this is a really compelling story, and it's not a one-off. It happens all the time. I gave a personal story of a candidate I'm working with, but Genevieve joined to talk about really interesting. She was out of recovery 6 or 7 years, entering the workforce for the first time. Didn't know what the pay range of the job was, just took whatever they offered her. She comes to find out 7 years later, after the company moving her to Boston, that she's actually paid close to $100,000 less than her male counterpart in the same role. And upon finding this out, she actually asked her company to do an audit, which now in Massachusetts is something that an employer, and it's part of the Equal Pay Act, you can ask for an audit. And the company fired her.
Wow.
They didn't know she already knew she was earning $100,000 less. And her point is that over the course of 6 years, I earned $600,000 less than my male counterpart. I don't own a home. And it was like taking advantage because they knew, right, that I hadn't worked in some time. And so when they offered this job to me, her not knowing what that salary range was set her back. And I'm going to give you another example, which I gave in the hearing just in my testimony. And just recently last week, I was working with a woman who, and this woman was just fired this summer. I was working with a woman and she works in upstate New York, and she took a job during COVID to work. She was unemployed. So she was working in like a quality control scientist role and only paid $55,000. This is a PhD with over 20 years of medicinal chemistry experience. And she was getting this offer to Boston, and the company was basically, asking her what her salary expectations were. And I said, do not put them down, right? Because her salary expectations would be 75, 80, right? She's already only earning 55. And so I said, do not answer that question. Well, do you know they came back and made her an offer at $145,000, which is commensurate with what she should be paid. But had she put down $75,000, they never would have brought the salary that high. So I think that, again, this just has real ramifications. And these kinds of things are happening every single day. And they contribute to the wage disparity that we have, which is wide. White women earn roughly 80 cents. Black women are at like 72. Latinas are at 51. It's a problem. We have to fix it.
You're just joining us. We're speaking with Megan Driscoll-Greenstein. She is the author, I would say. Is that accurate? The author of the Wage Transparency Bill here in the Commonwealth of Mass. If you're not sure about it, it's House Bill number 1950. And the Senate has a bill, 1208. And it was heard last Tuesday, by the Labor and Workforce Development Committee. Now, what was it like to sit and describe and give this testimony, and what is happening? What will happen next?
Yeah, so we should hear, in the next couple weeks, maybe 2 weeks. There were a lot of bills that day. It was virtual, which was interesting, and it made it in some ways easier, but in also other ways completely panic stricken, because what if the sound doesn't work, and what if my video cuts out, and what if all of my people who are coming for the panel, can't log in? And but it actually went really smoothly. I mean, they did a really nice job of making sure that went off the way it went off. So they did a great job. So yeah, we kind of just sitting and waiting and to figure out, they'll decide kind of what spot we go to next. And so the direction of which we approach is kind of like undetermined. So in the meantime, we got some really great press. The State House News put out a really nice article about our bill. So what my thought is to sort of make sure that all the co-sponsors have read that bill. I'll be reaching out to all of them. There's 50 of them, the legislative sponsors. And I've already done so much work with so many other chambers of commerce that my intention is to just continue to kind of like sew up those relationships and kind of close the gaps there and just get the sort of final coalition of business support sort of settled. So that's kind of what I plan to do over the next like 2 weeks while we wait.
Watching this build slowly, and you look back at it from its infancy, where you mentioned you had a mere 12 you know, sponsors who signed on to it, but it's ballooned to 50. And you've got so many of these other organizations who are willing to go in there. And it isn't just here on the South Shore. You get it across the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, which is astounding. What has it been like to see this progress to this point? And ultimately, I don't see it not being successful, but at least getting it to right here, right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been affirming, right? You know, I saw, as one of the largest recruiting companies, I saw this as an issue playing out with candidates and companies. And so what's now reflected in the support is, right, a broader group of people who are seeing this in the same way. It's cleaning up and making the Equal Pay Act even better, right? That was the necessary first step and absolutely had to happen. And so this is just kind of taking it another level. Now, it is interesting. I didn't know this, but Connecticut and Nevada both passed wage transparency bills in the last year. So they not only have the, you know, you can't ask what someone's earning, but then they went further to require companies to publish the pay range. Now, we're not requiring companies publish it. We're requiring that they share it upon request. Which I, you know, neither here nor there, but it's slightly different, but the same premise, you know. So I feel as though this is kind of the direction that with sunlight, right, with everything, when there's transparency, you know, we are able to make good decisions. Because I don't think that anybody would agree that we want to pay women and minorities less for the same work. I mean, we are on the same page that we have an issue and it's just how do we solve it? This is a real way that starting tomorrow, we can solve it. The other thing I will mention is that COVID has laid bare those disparities. And we have lost so many women and minorities to work, to being home, to dealing with everything that we dealt with, right? It disproportionately hurt women of color, women and women of color. And so how are we, what is the environment by which they are coming back, right? Is it gonna be like the woman who was in recovery 6 years and she just takes what she can get? Well, yeah. That is how women will enter the workforce again. They've been out of work for over a year, sometimes almost 2 years by the time school starts, right? Which is probably when we'll see an influx. What kind of environment are we offering them, right? And what kind of environment are they able to navigate through successfully when they don't know what the jobs pay that they're going to be applying for? When they're thinking, I just need a job at this point. I've been out of work for 2 years. My unemployment's gone. I need a job. So I think that the timing of this, and you know, and COVID almost has made this issue so much more important. And so that's also, I think, why I'm so much more motivated even than I was the first session.
As we get ready to wrap up our conversation, what are you looking, what does the road ahead look like if it's successfully reported out of the Labor and Workforce Development Committee? What are you looking, what's the next couple of steps that we can watch for, whether we're reading it in our local scribes or hearing it on the radio?
Yeah, well, Ways and Means will be obviously huge, and I'm, you know, we're going to end up there eventually, and then, you know, we want this on the floor, right? We want to vote on this ultimately. That's what we want, and the way to get that again is just to continue to speak to people and really kind of like pound the pavement. Ultimately, what happens is when I get to talk to somebody about this, you know, or Josh does, or Senator Jalen does, Rep. Cutler does, or Senator Jalen does, it's like a no brainer. People say that all the time. This is kind of like a win-win. No-brainer, why wouldn't we do it? It's the, you know, getting them on the phone and getting to speak to them. Now we've done that with 50. So I think we've just got to kind of reach out, because I think that women and people of color in the state want this, right? And we know that there's a large coalition of businesses, over 4,000 in the state, that want this, right? So that's done. It's just a matter of reaching out and making sure that the people hear how this benefits women and minorities in the state and how important that is right now. So hopefully you'll see us pass out a Ways and Means, get a vote on the floor. That would be amazing. Governor signs it into law.
Hip hip hooray, right?
Hip hip hooray by this time next year.
Well, and that's the good thing is that you have made a lot of progress early on in the legislative session that this, you know, we can only hope that it keeps ascending and moving along as it should and gaining that ultimately that vote on the floor as you're hoping for. And once that happens, again, it's, you know, maybe have you picked that? Have you already thought about what you're going to wear to the, are you going to be invited to the signing for this or what?
I would hope so. Yes. Yes. I believe I would. Yeah. I mean, I haven't gotten that ahead of myself because I do know that, you know, it would be very, I mean, this is really truly its first legislative session and it's not common. I mean, the Equal Pay Act took women 20 years of pushing that law forward, right? Like this was it is not easy to get these things done. And there's a lot of steps and a lot of people's opinions that have to be considered and we be considerate of, right? So I haven't really gotten ahead of myself to imagine that this is a done deal. I know that it's a lot of work that we still have to do and I respect that. And, you know, we'll come back at it if we need to, but I feel really good about it. I mean, I feel really good about, there's been no opposition to the bill. Even from really, I would say, conservative business groups that you would expect would be potentially concerned about anything that you're asking employers to do. They have been standing down and supportive in that way. And so I feel really good about it, you know, and I'm just going to kind of keep being grateful for everything that's happened so far and, you know, being hopeful for what's next.
She is Megan Driscoll-Greenstein, and she is, of course, the author of the Wage Transparency Bill right here in the Commonwealth of Mass. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, as usual.
You got it. We are going to step aside. And when we come back, hour number two of the show you're tuned into, Monday Night Talk here at 95.9 WATD. Stay tuned.
WATD FM Marshfield, WBMS Brockton. The South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. WATD. Streaming online at 95.9WATD.com. And with your smart speaker, just by saying play WATD.
Plymouth 400 Inc. continues their mission of education and commemoration of the 400th anniversary of Plymouth's founding with a new television series called Plymouth 400 Conversations. The program will focus on authors, filmmakers, artists, and poets who discuss how the 400th anniversary commemoration influenced their work. Each episode premieres Thursday nights at 7:30 on PAC-TV, but available online for everyone to see the following day. Despite the pandemic, the 400th anniversary commemoration continues into 2021 with great virtual programming now, including this fascinating new virtual series, and live events later in the year. See what Plymouth 400 Inc. has scheduled. Shop for Plymouth 400 anniversary merchandise to share with friends and family, and catch the most recent episode of Plymouth 400 Conversations. Visit Plymouth400Inc.org.
Okay, we have arrived at the final.
Do you check your Google search results regularly? You should. People often get their first impression of you or your business online. Negative comments on the internet can impact your life and your livelihood. Take control of your online reputation. Get your free reputation report card at reputationdefender.com. It may reveal negative posts from an ex-employee, upset patient or client, news article, legal issue, or even exposed personal information right there in your Google search results. Uncover what's lurking on the internet about you with reputationdefender.com's patented scan and get your free reputation report card. Or for immediate assistance with your reputation, call 800-401-6681. Our cutting-edge technology helps make your Google search results look their best. Call 800-401-6681. That's 800-401-6681. 800-401-6681. Or take the free scan at reputationdefender.com.
Be a part of the show. Call and join in on the conversation. 781-837-4900. Now, back to Monday Night Talk.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk, hour number two of the radio program. And later on this hour, the one and only Junior D'Amato returns to the radio program, a long overdue. And so we'll talk about a bunch of different things, how he has dealt with the pandemic, some of the new vehicles that he's trying, all that great stuff that we normally depend on Junior for. The one sad note here is that my next guest, and also has been my co-host from time to time, usually is a vital part of that segment. Who am I talking about? None other than Joe Flood himself. Joe Rossi usually likes to be a part of that. He's my guest, but he will not be a part of the Junior D'Amato segment, at least for this time. Joe, how are you today?
I'm great, Kevin. How are you? And I am sad. I have a new vehicle I was going to talk to Junior about, but we'll talk to him next time because I can give him a review of what I think about it.
Excellent. Excellent. Just to start off the conversation, how are things going and what's new?
Things are great. It will be widely known soon enough that I've recently ended my over 4 years, my time at Rogers Gray Insurance. I mention that because I depart on the absolute best of terms with that team, and they're growing and they're partnering with a new company as well and growing. And, you know, they took a chance on me, Kevin, when no one else would. And so I want to thank Rogers Gray Insurance and best of luck, everybody there. So if people are wondering, how do you get a hold of Joe Flood and how can Joe Flood help you in the future? Well, obviously, as chair and executive director of the Massachusetts Coastal Coalition, you can always reach out. Our website has all of our contact information. It's NoFlood, K-N-O-W, NoFlood.org. And then, of course, I'm becoming an independent consultant, and there's more to that that I can't really talk a lot about now, but just know that I'm not going anywhere. In fact, I'm probably getting even more involved in Flood in the future. So just want to make sure that I made that announcement so that everybody knew that, hey, he's not Rogers Gray. You know, things were great there. They're a great company, and I'm on my own.
Well, again, but that doesn't change as far as when I have, announced you on previous programs. The one caveat that I share is that there are few who understand flood insurance. The FEMA flood maps, you have really invested a lot of time and energy, not only into disseminating this information, but attending conferences, national conferences, spoke at conferences, been a feature speaker. You've done it all in such a, an extended amount of time that you are going to be, you'll be standing at the top of the peak eventually as the guy who has all that essential information.
Yeah, and it's funny, Kevin, this week I'm actually speaking at the National Flood Conference, so that will only continue. My role in the space is not changing, just where I'm playing that role is going to. So, I'm still here and around, like I said, with announcements coming in the future, people will see that I'm only more involved in the flood space from where I have been in the past.
So where are things? So if I use the term risk rating or risk rating 2.0, what am I talking about?
Well, what you're talking about is the largest change in the National Flood Insurance Program in the last 53 years. And we are like a bullet train. We are flying towards the goal line here for risk rating 2.0. And what I think will make people really think about how close we are to getting to risk rating 2.0 is that even though implementation starts October 1st, the quoting, so the ability to give somebody a quote on a flood policy and risk rating 2.0 starts in August 1st. So we're only a month away from being able to tell somebody what their new rate will be under risk rating 2.0. Now, what it is basically FEMA is changing the way that they're basing, that they're rating structures, their methodology. They're going from you're in an A zone or a V zone or an X zone, and your rate is this, this, or this. And then there's all these other scenarios like grandfathering stuff that play in, to using catastrophic modeling, right? So catastrophe models that actually say you're this far from the water and the water could potentially get this high and your building is this far from ground level versus the height of like a base flood elevation, which is what we currently use. And believe it or not, after all the fuss that we make about what zone you're in, zone will no longer matter for insurance ratings. So I think it's really important to keep all of this in context, because there's going to be a lot of changes coming, and people are going to need to really pay attention here, because if you're prepared, then the change, you know, you can understand what's happening and we can walk through those changes. But if all of a sudden you get a new insurance bill or document that says, hey, all these changes are happening, there could be a lot of confusion. So we're trying to get the word out there about these coming changes, and they're coming soon.
You say zone will not matter. Well, if I'm not in a particular zone, then is there another terminology that I need to know? Or is this kind of a blanket type of coverage that we're going to need to prepare ourselves for?
Well, I guess, you know, zone will matter, you know, for only one purpose, and it won't be insurance rating. It will be whether you're in or out of the requirement to carry flood insurance. So that will not be changing. If you're in an A or V zone, the lenders will still require you to have flood insurance. If you're not in those zones, then you won't be required to carry it. But of course, we encourage people to still carry flood insurance. Now, let's go back, because we're talking only about insurance rating here. From a zone perspective, zones will not matter, because when you think about like distance to water doesn't really matter about zone, right? If you're close to the water right now, in theory, you could be in a V zone. And if you're far away, you could be in an A zone. But all of that is going to change. So the terminology will just be distance to water, height above the ground level. So in some ways, Kevin, this is easier for the average person to understand, right? If you're standing 1,000 feet away from the water, your risk is going to simply be lower than if you're close to the water. I mean, I think that's a much easier concept for most people to understand. And so is the distance from the ground. You know, we don't have to explain, you know, the base flood elevation and what that terminology is. It's basically if you're standing on the ground and your floor is 10 feet above that ground, then there's a discount, you know, depending on where that floor is in relation to the ground. So, you know, there are some good and some bad coming out of risk grading 2.0. But I think there's two major things that people should take away. One, it sounds like this big albatross coming down the highway here, but it's actually going to make the conversations around flood insurance a little bit easier to understand. And then two, people are going to actually start having conversations about flood insurance that they've never had before, like asking, well, you know, what is the cost and what does this actually mean and what is the risk of my property?
So it seems like an oversimplification of the process.
Yeah, it's basically the mechanics behind getting you the rate are fairly complicated, but the inputs to getting it are actually fairly simple. In fact, that can be seen in how many questions FEMA currently asks versus to get a quote versus how many they will be asking. Right now, if I want to get somebody a flood insurance quote through FEMA, I've got to answer 60 questions in order to get that quote. In risk grading 2.0, that number goes down to about 20. So that is, again, even though those inputs are more sophisticated behind the scenes, then they're actually, it's going to be a simpler process.
Can you just, if you are just tuning in, we are speaking with the one and only Joe Flood, Joe Rossi. He is, I believe is it the president of the Massachusetts Coastal Coalition?
Yep, president, chair, executive director, those titles all work for my role there. You know, and also, Kevin, joefloodrossi.com kind of encapsulates all the stuff I'm working on and doing. So if people want to see all the other committees I'm on and things that I'm doing, they can go there.
It's like a bibliography of who Joe Rossi is.
Yeah, and also a great way to stay in touch with all the new things I've got going on.
One of the things that you and I usually will get together and talk about on a regular basis, because I've prided myself on making sure that you're able to come on. I know you do updates with the South Shore's Morning News on a regular basis, but I feel that's kind of a that's kind of a sample size,
yeah,
compared to what we're able to do. We're really able to kind of dig down. But one of the conversations, the reoccurring conversations, is about the government's federal flood program. Anything you want to talk about with that, or that anything they were looking for? Is there going to be any? I mean, the one question that usually comes up is it going to be extended? Are there going to be any modifications? Where does that stand?
So, you know, we were just talking about the change in rating. Well, insurance is one of the three main parts of the federal flood insurance program, as you highlighted, yep. Kevin. There's mapping, which people are very familiar with. There's the insurance, and then there's mitigation. So in grants, some people put grants as the fourth leg. I kind of include them in mitigation, right? This ability to elevate buildings, you know, federally fund those projects. So that whole program is what the National Flood Insurance Program is, and that comes up for expiration every so often. And we're in our, since 2017, when the program originally expired, we're now in our 16th short-term extension, barreling towards September 30th. You know, if what I said earlier about risk rating 2.0 is it's implemented October 1st, or that's when it starts. The federal program expires on September 30th. You can see that there's a lot going on within about 2 or 3 days of each other. So when it comes to federal legislation on extending that September 30th deadline, there's been a lot of activity, but this is so familiar to 2017 and 2018. 2019, I'm sorry. 2019 was the last time that a big effort was put into moving the ball forward here. And what happened in those 2 years is there was a lot of excitement. Bills were proposed. They made it to committee. There were markups done. And then things went quiet over the summer. And then the hurricanes happened in the fall. And then the ball just keeps getting kicked down the road. I was very hopeful and still am that this could finally be the year that something gets done. Mostly because there's a lot of big bills out there that have room to put the National Flood Insurance Program's extension. You know, you've got the federal infrastructure bill. That may actually become two bills. You've got the federal, and then there are standalone bills to extend the National Flood Insurance Program that have already been proposed. And there's a bunch of them. You know, we're doing an update for the COSA Coalition and sending it out sometime this week. And we were trying to dissect all the bills out there, and I think our list is like 15 different bills that try to reform the program in some way. And the problem, though, is that you've got all these bills in the House, you've got a couple bills in the Senate, you've got risk rating 2.0 happening. Can we reconcile all of those by September 30th? I would say probably not. Now, will something happen? There's a better chance that there's at least one bill that makes it, through this year. But my estimation is we need more time than September 30th. And if we get a big hurricane, then you can just take it all off the table. So I think that, you know, we're in a very similar situation as we were in 17, as we were in 19, and here we are 2 years later in 21. So I remain hopeful. We've gotten further than we have those last two times, but we're still not able to really take this and push it across the finish line at this point.
See, my thought is knowing that we have a new administration that has done a lot of things, not only getting monies in the hands of American families, not only giving monies to states and municipalities, but also looking to do infrastructure bills to be able to do roads and bridges. I've just kind of felt like this administration is looking to tend to some of the things that kind of stalled under the previous, and one would think that this would be one of those top 10 items that would also get a little bit of extra attention.
Yeah, and it is. You know, what's really interesting is in the president's, I think it was like $4 or $6 trillion budget, about $400 million of that budget was going to be given to families to buy flood insurance, low-income families. We have struggled, and risk rating 2.0 won't solve this, but there's been an affordability issue that has lasted for the last 20 years in the National Flood Insurance Program. This idea that there needs to be some type of affordability program, and many believe it needs to be carved out of the NFIP, meaning not part of it at all, in another like HUD or another place where federal grants can be given to people to buy either flood insurance or subsidize their premium or something. And I think the inclusion of that money was, to your point, Kevin, the administration's kind of, hey, this is a top priority. We need people to have flood insurance. I don't think the framework is really there yet. I think it's great, though, that the money is being appropriated. But I go back to, you know, the actual extension and reform of the program itself. What we run into most of the time with this is a battle between geographies. It's mostly, I say mostly because it is somewhat partisan, but it's really not in the grand scheme of things. You've got New York, you've got Louisiana, and you've got the northern, the northwest part of the country that really have some strong senators that all feel different, all feel one way about the program. And then you've got people in other places of the country who feel another way. So, you know, you've in this internal battle is what kind of can cause this issue to linger. And so, you know, we'll see what happens here. We're getting down to September 30th. It's coming quick. But I would tell people that, look, we've seen it 16 times before. We'll see it probably another few times. We will get a short-term extension should it come down to the wire.
And again, if you are just tuning in, we're speaking with Joe Rossi. Joe Flood, check out his website, Joe Flood Rossi, RossiRossi.com. He's also the executive director of the Massachusetts Coastal Coalition and joins us on a regular basis. Something happened recently in the town of Rockland here on the South Shore where there was a vote that was taken in regards to leaving a program. Give me some background on that and give me the ramifications to such an action.
That's yes, exactly. And you know, I think this is going to be a great segue into the, you know, talking about some of the great benefits that the NFIP provides our communities. You know, it's really, the National Flood Insurance Program is a voluntary program, right? 26,000 communities in this country, roughly, and that's between city, county, and regional governments, tribal governments. And out of those 26,000, 22,000 participate in the NFIP. Up to recently, 10 in Mass did not. So out of 350 communities, obviously the ones that don't participate are a minority. And those 10, for the most part, are in places where either there's not a lot of homes or there's not a lot of regulated floodplain. And they usually go together, right? Not a lot of regulated floodplain in areas where there's not a lot of homes. We have a map change coming in this region, right? South Shore. We haven't talked a lot about it because it's really not changing a lot of things. I think the biggest change our area has is going to be, like in Marshfield, for example, I think two buildings move in or out of the high-risk flood zone with this map change. So it's really not a huge change. The town of Rockland, though, unfortunately, if you don't adopt the flood maps, you're kicked out of the National Flood Insurance Program. And there was a coalition of individuals who came together, organized or unorganized, I'm not sure, to have the community vote down the adoption of those new flood maps coming in here in about a week or two. Unfortunately, you know, the messaging around why, I've heard a couple different things. But at the end of the day, there's 53 NFIP policies in the town. Upon those policies coming up for renewal, NFIP will not allow them to be renewed. In addition to that, no one can buy an NFIP or federal policy in the town. Now, some people may think 53 policies, not a big deal, small floodplain, you know, there's not a lot of floodplain. But I think the problem here is the forward-looking thought on this, right? When we look at, you know, ASFPM, the Association of State Floodplain Managers, estimates that there's a million unmapped miles of stream in our country. And so the argument is always, well, they're unmapped because there's no one there yet. And that's the problem, is that when we look at future development, future development, whether we like it or not, is going to happen in our floodplain.
Right.
And when you have communities that have even some floodplain, but they're no longer regulated because they're not in the high-risk flood zone, that's a problem. And I think that as we look at what the NFIP does for our communities, whether it be offering discounts on flood insurance through the community rating system, which many South Shore communities are taking advantage of, whether it be the ability to get flood insurance at discounted levels than you would be maybe in the private sector, or whether it be the $2 billion a year that floodplain management avoids in flood losses, right? The ability to have restrictions on how you build in these high-risk flood zones actually avoids flood losses. And that study was just updated a couple of years ago. That number grew. When we look at a community like Rockland Leaving, these are the problems that it presents.
Probably just a quick follow-up question to that is there the town opting up? Does it come at a cost savings? And that, was that the reason? Or was it because there was not enough participation that warranted to remain in the program?
My understanding, Kevin, is that there have been changes. So FEMA, on all the communities across the country, every community, when they adopt flood maps, they have to adopt a bylaw that says what they will and won't do in their high-risk flood zone. FEMA has asked them to update those bylaws, and they're things that really should have been done anyways. FEMA was just asking a lot of the towns to formalize their floodplain bylaws. My understanding is there were some individuals that felt that that bylaw would have said that people could either do things or not do things that they used to be able to do in the regulated floodway, which is just not the case. I think the biggest change coming for the new bylaw is it formalizes that any type of work in a floodplain must have a permit. That's anything: fences, flagpoles, driveways. It's not that they're not allowed to do them. There just needs to be a formalized process to get a permit to do them, where maybe you wouldn't need one in a non-regulated floodway. In fact, in Marshfield, I'm very proud of working with the building commissioner there, Andrew Stewart, to implement a floodplain permit. So we're actually not only adopting this new bylaw in Marshfield, we're actually asking people to apply for a special permit to do this work. So, you know, and this is a best practice. This is because, we have damage that happens in our floodplains, and we need to regulate that. So again, what I'm getting at here is that I believe that's what the issue was. But I can tell you that the floodplain bylaw, the new one that was updated, has no additional restrictions. I mean, certainly if you want to look at the floodplain permit as something that could be technically restrictive, it's just a formalization of something that should have been already happening in communities.
Joey, we're plumb almost out of time here. We got about 3 or 4 minutes left in our conversation. Anything that you want to do to kind of put a pretty bow on this conversation, or maybe there's a little more information that you want to share with us prior to us closing on our conversation?
Yeah, I think just going back to risk rating 2.0, it's not all rosy, right? There's going to be some challenges here in the future, but we at the Massachusetts COSA Coalition have compiled all the information out there, right? There's a lot of information going around about risk rating 2.0. There's data sheets, state data sheets, there's recordings of webinars, there's a lot of stuff. So we have a page on our website. You just hover over our updates in one of the tabs at the top there, and you'll see drop down risk rating 2.0. If you tap on that, you're going to see all the downloads that you can imagine relating to risk rating 2.0. So I think that's really critical, because we're going to be posting updates there. We're sending out updates to those on our email list. So just stay informed, because there are big changes coming. Some people will see refunds, and some people will owe more money. I mean, it's premiums are going up and down. But I think what we'll see in the future here is just the more information, the better. And I will tease that the Massachusetts COSA Coalition will be hosting a risk rating 2.0 in-person event. So we're trying to get back in person. We will be hosting it in the fall after everything is implemented, because we Congress could say that to stop Risk Rating 2.0. I mean, it is possible. We don't think it'll happen, but it's possible. So we want to wait till things are moving. So sometime in the October and November timeframe, look out for that announcement, because we will be doing a Risk Rating 2.0 in-person event.
Joe, as always, I appreciate your knowledge, your information on this subject matter. And I think a lot of our listeners, I do hear from my listeners who, you know, there's some conversations they hear part of the way through and they go, this isn't for me. But I do hear from a lot of our listeners who appreciate when you're on and some of the information that you share with them, because it's the latest with certain programs. And, you know, it's there also, let's not forget here, if in fact we have some kind of a godlike a natural occurrence and there's water involved, they're going to make sure that they are protected and that they're able to recoup if in fact there are damages, because we have those conversations as to how to best serve yourself if you do suffer damage due to a flood.
Yeah, and you know, it's hurricane season, right? We haven't been hit since 91. It is imminent, so make sure you're taking those precautions. Like you said, get flood insurance. There's typically a 30-day wait, between 14 and 30 days. Hey, just last week, we had a tropical depression off of our coast. It's happening. We're live, so you know, people need to pay attention.
He is Joe Rossi, Joe Flood, joeflood.rossi.com, R-O-S-S-I. Joe, again, thank you for your time, my friend.
Yes, thank you for having me, Kevin.
We will take a small break. And when we come back, as promised, Junior D'Amato, the car doctor, he returns to Monday Night Talk right here at 95.9 WATD.
I'm CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger with a quick tip from H2O Wireless on stretching your budget and saving money every month. Start with your recurring monthly bills. And here's the easiest one, your cell phone bill. Here's how to get the best deal. This month, dial #250 and say keyword get H2O. You'll save an additional 50% off your first month. Dial #250 and say get H2O for this exclusive offer.
This is a metaphor for your business's journey. Sometimes it feels like the world is throwing everything it has at you. And to succeed, you need someone to guide you through. That's what Dell Technologies Advisors do. They have the tech advice to help you navigate whatever challenges you're up against and get you safely to where you want to be.
For advice on solutions like XPS 13 laptops powered by Intel Evo platform, call an advisor today at 877-ASK-DELL.
Army National Guard is about more than serving your country. It's about being there for your community when your neighbors need you most. The Army National Guard makes college affordable, and serving part-time can help you graduate debt-free. Do you want to stay close to friends and family? The Guard allows you to serve close to home. Serving part-time in the Army National Guard lets you have the life you want. Learn more by visiting NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Massachusetts Army National Guard. Aired by the Massachusetts Broadcasters Association and this station.
If you have unfiled taxes or are in debt to the IRS, this is important news. The IRS just rolled out a new program to help struggling taxpayers more easily resolve their tax problems. It's called the Taxpayer Relief Initiative, and it opens up powerful new options for people looking to get back on the right track with the IRS. And no one knows this program like the professionals at Optima Tax Relief, America's most trusted tax resolution company. They've resolved over $1 billion in tax debt for their clients and have the expertise and experience to help you. One easy call to Optima can start the process, helping to put an end to your worries of wage garnishment, asset seizure, and other aggressive IRS actions. Make today the beginning of your fresh start with the IRS. Call the experts at Optima Tax Relief now for your free confidential consultation.
Call 800-343-6460. 800-343-6460. 800-343-6460.
Optima Tax Relief.
Some restrictions apply. For complete details, please visit OptimaTaxRelief.com.
Hey, it's John Shea here from Almost Famous Radio, introducing you to independent band musicians from across New England every Tuesday night, 8 to 10, brought to you by Tiny and Sons Glass. Tomorrow night, we have yet another full night of music for you. tons of new music and upcoming shows to let you know about, and we'll be joined on the tiny stage by country singer-songwriter Christian Montgomery. That's tomorrow, 8 to 10, right here on 95.9 WATD and online at 95.9WATD.com.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk.
Okay, we have arrived at the final segment of Monday Night Talk. I always say, usually the final segment of the radio program is the best segment. Not that I don't like all the other segments, but I don't know, just something, a little extra gusto in that final segment. Joining us is a good friend, somebody who has been a reoccurring guest. When it comes to automotive information and technology, he is tops. He is the car doctor from writing for local newspapers or newspapers across the country to doing his own radio program. We have joining us the car doctor himself, the one and only Junior D'Amato. How are you, sir? Hey, first, before I start, don't I owe you a happy belated birthday?
You know, Kevin, the birthdays go and go and go. And yeah, we hit 70 the other day, and it was okay.
You don't wonderful. Look it. You don't look it or sound it.
You know what? It's because of the wonderful wife I have behind me, Kevin, that just keeps pushing and pushing and pushing.
Well, kudos to Miss Carla. And we thank her, and we thank you for joining us tonight. I thought it was a timely segment to have with you because, you know, we look back, if we get in our time machine and we go back 13 months ago, 14 months ago, April, May of 2020, we're in the height of the pandemic. What was the automotive industry like at that particular time? It was like people weren't going anywhere. And you probably didn't see a lot of folks coming to the shop because they weren't driving a lot. We were all kind of locked down. Take me through the scenario as someone who...
Well, it was an interesting time, Kev. The car dealerships basically shut a lot of their stuff down, and the sales department was pretty much non-existent. We let our guys know that if they wanted to stay and play, they could. If they wanted to, you know, take the nasty plunge and go get off and not work for a while. And a few of them took that, you know, advice. And they said, you know what, I think I'm going to take a little time out to see what this is going to go. They were very scared and very much worried about this whole pandemic thing. Five of us stayed at the shop, and I got to tell you, it was the only trouble we had was getting some auto parts. People were still very much active with getting the cars repaired, and the masks were a big deal. I wish I had a mask company back then, Kev.
Yeah, we would have made some big money if we had known it was going to be the thing that everybody needed.
Yeah. It was pretty crazy at that time. A lot of things like our pharmaceutical people that, you know, drive around and deliver pharmaceuticals, the drugs, the beds, the stuff for the elderly, they were very, very busy as well. Again, getting back to the cars, the car sales took a real nosedive. I even bought myself a Wrangler back then because it was such a crazy amount of money off, and you never lose money on a Wrangler. And just looking right now at where we are, 13, 14 months later, it was like nothing ever happened.
But I'm hearing more and more that compared to 13, 14 months ago, it's not as easy to be able to purchase an automobile, whether it's new or used. Is that true?
That is very, very true. The repair industry has pretty much been status quo. Maybe even been a slight increase because people are fixing their cars now more so than ever. If you want to buy a used car, Kevin, and you look at, you know, either Kelley Blue Book, any of the other sites that are out there, the guy with that Fox, he's pretty cool there. They do a nice job, you know, to get your car checked. You know, you check check for actors and all that stuff. The pricing of used cars has gone through the roof. The selling of new cars has diminished. The leasing of new cars has gone through the roof. People are about a 70-30 now, 70% being leased, 30% being purchased, and the purchasing rate has gone from a mere 4-year loan to 5- and 6-year loans. That's right. The percentage of interest has gone through the roof as well. The super buy now 0%, you know, blah, 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 and all that sign and drive, sign then drive with like Volkswagen. A lot of that has changed. You've got to have really good credit. The one thing we must warn people about is some of the interest rates. I've seen interest rates, Kevin, sit down 24%.
Wow.
24%. And that's buy here, pay here, Kevin.
That sounds like, isn't it? Sounds like legalized loan sharking.
You want some legalized loan sharking? You know what a documentation fee is.
Oh, yeah. You and I have talked about it. We've talked about it all the time.
Okay. Massachusetts has set the price limit on what they call a documentation fee. Pick a number. How much?
$198.
$899.
Really?
$900.
Wow.
The average doc fee right now at most car dealerships is $500 to $700.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're not but just... You're not whistling Dixie. Yeah, because you and I have talked about this a number of times. And I remember, I want to say about 3-4 years ago, I was looking for a new vehicle. And there was actually a place I went to that told me it was like $699. And I go, well, what's that? Why are you charging me that? That's kind of high. He goes, well, it's the process of paperwork. I'm like, really? How much does it cost to process paperwork? It's interesting that they're allowed to. It's almost like you have to add that additional money on top of whatever the sticker price is.
Well, you know, I'm in the wholesale business as well, and I've got a license. And believe it or not, there are a few dealerships, a few, that want to charge people like me. All you do is you weren't here. I want this car $7,000. Pick a number. Oh, you're giving them a check for $7,000 for the car. There's no warranty. All they do is just sign the back of the title. Wait a minute. Kevin, come back here. We need to get a documentation fee. For what? There is no title. There's no changing of anything. You're just getting a check for your car. Well, if you don't like it, then you can go to the auction. You can pay the fees. Now, here, you ready for this? That same car for $7,000 goes to the auction. The dealership pays roughly anywhere from 3 to 8%, maybe 10%. The buyer, say me, has to pay 10%. So now that $7,000 car has a 10% fee on top of that I have to pay, whether I like it or not. Am I better off just paying the dealer the pull the gun out of his pocket and say, hey, this is what it's going to cost me?
Yeah.
Now, the same thing happens, believe it or not, with some of the marine industry people like boating. And not all car dealerships, and there are some of these people are advertising on TV, do not charge a dock fee, and they deliver the car right to your office, house, or wherever.
Yeah, are you talking about like a Carvana?
Yes. And some of those places like Carvana, and there's a couple of other people out there that sell CarMax is another one.
Yep.
You might want to check them. A lot of those places, they don't hit you with a dock fee. And some of the car maxes out there, they're national, and they buy cars that are very low turn-in lease cars, and they have the power and the money to buy outbuy a lot of the other people out there, especially car dealerships. And let's say that you found your Fiat that you really fell in love with, or whatever you wanted, the Miata, and it's in Carolina, North Carolina, South Carolina, even Texas. And you go down to your local, CarMax. Geez, this is what we have available. You know what? I'm going to take that. Well, Kevin, just give me $1,000 refundable deposit if you don't like it, and we'll have the car brought up from Texas. And this is what the car was going to cost. This is what it is. It's everything we say it is. If it's not, you don't have to buy it. Wow. It's amazing how they make it happen. Those places have really come a long way, Kevin.
I have to tell you, my stepdaughter actually bought a SUV through Carvana. And I was like, you're kidding me. She goes, nope. She goes, I picked it on the website. They delivered it the next day. I go, you're kidding me. She goes, nope. I go, what do you think? She goes, love it. And she was happier. You know, she was so happy. And it was her second time buying a vehicle. And she felt that buying it through a car vending machine, per se, like a Carvana, was a much better experience than going to a dealership and having to go through the rigmarole of talking to a salesperson who, you know, has got the full court press on you to, you got to buy this car. She didn't have any of that.
Yep. Well, some of the, let's get right to the point, Mr. Kev. Some of the car salespeople are very bad.
Yeah.
Some of the waiters and waitresses are very bad. And some of the guys that fix cars are very bad. And, you know, there are some really good people in car dealerships that can help you out. And when it comes to, there's a couple of guys out there, we don't sell cars, we help you buy them.
Yeah.
That's a Chambers line that he used. It's a good line. And they've come up with an idea. It's called smart pricing. This is the price, Kevin. It's $29.95, $30, whatever the price is. You want to buy it, Kevin? You buy it. You don't want to buy it? Well, thank you very much for coming in. Have an apple on your way out or have a cold water, whatever, and call it a day. But if you do buy the car, it's whatever the price is, plus $5 to $6 or $7 or $8.99 for a dock fee.
Right.
You don't like it, Kevin? Thank you very much again.
Again,
and that's the way it is.
If you are just tuning in, we are speaking with the great Junior D'Amato, automotive expert. As you may or may not know, he actually has a shop located in down on the South Shore, South Coast, in Middleborough, and has been how many decades have you been an expert or been in the automotive industry?
Too many, Kevin.
Too many.
I'm talking probably, I don't know, what am I, 70 years old? I started playing around at 13 or 14.
A lot of years.
So you can do the numbers. And, you know, in fact, my AAA guy was just in here the other day. And he says, hey, Junior, your ASC certifications are starting to time out. You've got to get those done. Or I have to take my AAA sign off your shop. That's how critical AAA is. About having their AAA certified repair facilities, you know, 110% and ASE certified. They're not screwing around. And, you know, the cars today, believe it or not, if you've got a late model car and it has any of the accident avoidance systems in it, Kevin, and it has the side detection systems, oops, Kevin, I just bumped into your car, I knocked your mirror off, or I hit your bumper, hypothetically. Just to reevaluate or realign and get all the avoidance systems back in line, the machinery, like in the front end alignment, the machinery for setting the cameras and all the distance problems, you know, the backup cameras and the avoidance collision and the lane changing, lane keeping and all that, that can take 6 to 7 hours to set all that back up after you've been in the slightest little fender bender. And the insurance companies are spending the money to have the technicians at the body shops take the time to set all that up, and they're paying an astronomical amount of money for that, believe it or not. Because if you have a let's say a Honda and you happen to break the passenger mirror off hitting your garage door or someone sideswipes you, that's like $2,000 by the time you're done for a passenger mirror with a camera.
You know, Junior, knowing you're somebody who's, you've worked on so many different types of model cars, whether it's their American, domestic or foreign, looking at today's modern vehicle, I remember when I first, you know, got a car and, you know, you wanted to get a car that was newer and had lower miles. But is it true that today's car, you could surpass 150,000 miles or 200,000 miles or 250,000 miles, and it's still a darn good car? Is that true or false?
Absolutely, perfectly true.
Why is that?
Well, You want to go back, Kevin? We can go back to the olden days and then just fast forward to today. Engine oil, fuel mixture, engines running hotter, more efficient, better parts in the engines. It's not like it used to be. In 1980, we had vehicles like the Corvette that was 170 to 200 horsepower, and we were flying back in that day. Go back to 1970, and we had 450 and 500 horsepower cars, engines in the Chevys, the Fords, and the Mopars that could not last 50,000 miles, couldn't last 25,000 miles. Today, we have vehicles that are anywhere from 5 to 800 plus horsepower. And I wish Joe Rossi was with us tonight. Next year, there's going to be a very limited edition of Dodge Challengers with 1,000 horsepower.
Holy cow.
Making 200 of these cars. They're $200,000, street legal, pass emissions, 1,000 horsepower. Okay, now let's go back to a V8 engine in 1996, 320 horsepower maybe, with about 32,000 of V8 like the Cadillac Northstar. And now we have six cylinders with 300 plus horsepower, or even 600 horsepower, depending on if they got turbos or not. The amount of precise fuel management and the excellent oil lubrication factors that we have and the design of the engines has really changed everything. So, yeah, I've got two loaner cars with 200 and change on each one of them, and they run perfectly. You can drive it to California or Florida, no problem.
Yeah, let's talk about that. That's another thing that you, another aspect of our conversation that I've always enjoyed is that, you know, you are able to test drive these different vehicles and share your thoughts on them. And what's some of the latest vehicles that you've been able to get behind the wheel of and take out for a spin?
Well, the taking out of a spin, Kevin, these days is come to a point that now we are required to take pictures of vehicles, to send pictures in, and to, you know, you always gave your honest opinion of the vehicles, but now they want a much more precise, picturesque display of these vehicles on Facebook and things like that, which we're just starting to do now, like the Zoom meetings and stuff like that has changed. I'm finally learning how to do it. The past 6 months, I've had just about every kind of vehicle you can think of, except GM cars, no Ford cars. And Kevin's going to say, well, why?
Yeah,
well,
why?
Let me ask Kevin a question.
Yes.
When was the last time you saw a GM, Ford, a Chrysler automobile on TV advertised? A car.
I don't know. It's been a while. It's more SUVs and pickup.
Oh, cars. Thank you, Kevin.
Yep.
Okay. So we're talking SUVs. We're talking trucks. We're driving a lot of them. GM, Ford, and Chrysler, basically, I don't think are too much into the automobile business anymore, unfortunately. You have Nissan is in it now. Volkswagen has even got away from the automobiles, and they're into their SUVs, as you see on TV. Mm-hmm. And they changed their commercials, sign and then drive. They changed the wording because they got in a little trouble with that. But, yeah, the Kias, the Hyundais, I just cannot believe how these vehicles have come around the corner. Fiat Chrysler is now somebody else, I guess. And we've had a lot of their vehicles, a lot of Jeeps. The new TRX, that is a $93,000 pickup truck with Hellcat power, 707 horsepower. The new Jeep Rubicon with the 392 Hemi, which is 480. We just gave that back today. And it was just, I would have loved to have just stolen that car, Kevin. I got to tell you, it was more like a sports car than it was a Jeep. Hang a plow on it and go plow in the wintertime. You know, take the plow off, go up the mountains, or go to the New England Dragway and have some fun with it, or just blow off Kevin Tachi and a set of lights in his Corvette. You know, it'd be crazy.
If you're just tuning in, we are speaking with the great Junior D'Amato. He is a fantastic auto expert who tells it the way it is. He's been dealing with not only being under the hood, but being able to take it out for rides and knows the automotive industry probably better than anybody on the East Coast. If you would, you know, you're kind of teasing, going, "Oh, I didn't want to give this back." What is it like to have a vehicle that you enjoy so much that you're like going, "Do I really want to go buy one of these?" Because I really enjoyed, you know, the couple of days I was able to test drive it.
Well, the job that we have to do is that both my wife and Carla, she gets now to give her 2 cents in the vehicles and tell me about it. Like, she just complained about a vehicle the other day that we had. It was a new, I think it was some kind of a Kia or Hyundai. Beautiful car. Her complaint was, it was a G80. It was the same car. There you go. It was a G80 Genesis that Tiger Woods had that accident with.
Oh.
And she says, "This is a great vehicle. The only problem is it's hard for her to get in." And that will be put in print that, you know, for someone that's, you know, 5'5", 5'6", it's a bit difficult for someone with short legs to get into the vehicle. But what a car. It was really, what an SUV. It was really, really nice. It was $72,000.
Yeah, it's incredible the amount that it costs for a brand new vehicle. And again, as we were talking, you know, we were talking earlier and talking, you know, during the break, that, you know, cars are getting harder and harder to come by. If you have a used car, being able to buy a used car, you know, it's almost like, you know, housing stock these days, the real estate, like you were saying a few minutes ago, it's tough to be able to grab something. And so if you see something, don't hesitate.
If you see something, Mr. Kevin, you've got to step up. You've got to buy it. And the other thing is, for anybody that's interested in being a technician, this is a demanding world. It is a lot of hours, but you can reap the benefits over time doing it, and both male and female. And here's the biggie, Kevin. I don't want to get greasy and dirty. Well, guess what? They're not going to get greasy and dirty anymore. You need to understand how the system works. Once you understand how the system in any system, whether it's a dishwasher, a washing machine, a dryer, an oven, an automobile, a truck, once you understand that somebody put this thing together and they have a trouble chart or a format to go ahead and diagnostically test everything, and that's what we're doing right now in the automotive industry. The majority of us are testing, finding bad wires, finding bad grounds, using outside informational services to help us out with it. And as far as, you know, the dirty, greasy pulling motors and stuff like that, taking complete engines apart, the engines are fine. It's the electronics, Kevin, that are giving people a grief and the problem. So if anybody has any interest in the South Shore area, we have that Silver Lake High School, the technical vocational school down there in your neck of the woods.
Yeah.
Great, great place. You have the Bourne school down there by the bridge. They're very, very, very good. And there's always an opportunity. And believe it or not, Kevin, the auto body industry is another industry that people can really go forward and strive for. There's a lot of us, Kevin, that have a lot of trouble with algebra. They may have trouble spelling, even English. That's okay. You can still become a professional technician in whatever trade you want. So people need to look at that.
Yeah, and I was going to, you know, as you were kind of giving details about if someone wanted to be a technician, knowing that because of the pandemic, there are a lot of industries and trades that are seeing a struggle to be able to have qualified individuals or individuals who are willing to do said jobs. Is that an area that is getting tougher and tougher to find folks who want to come in and diagnose a vehicle or turn a wrench or be able to work in a shop? Is that a trade that the folks are going away from these days?
Oh, of course, Kevin. It's really changed a lot. It's just not like it used to be. People, when I was growing up in school, wanted to get involved with the automobile industry, automobile trade. Now things have changed completely where I don't want to do that. I just want to push a pencil. I want to do something different. And you know what? Good, that's okay. You have the video world. Who ever thought that you could, you know, become a successful person playing video games.
Right.
So that is a professional living government.
It is.
I mean, think about it. We've come a long way from Larry Glick and Jerry Williams.
Amen. Well, we got just a couple of minutes left here. Anything that you want to say? We got, like I said, about 2 or 3 minutes left. Anything you want to say to kind of wrap up this fantastic program?
Yeah, I think that a lot of people need to, again, getting away from all of this that we've had this great conversation with, people really need to pay attention with the basics of their vehicles. Never let a car go below a quarter of a tank of fuel. It's the worst thing you can do. Gas pumps in the gas tank, they call them fuel pumps. They're lubricated and cooled by the gasoline. You go below a quarter, the thing starts to cavitate, the pump, and it gets overheated, and bingo, they go bad. Usually after people put gas in them, because you get that hot fuel pump, now you get the cold gas going into the tank, a boom. Price of oil is all over the map. I see signs at a lot of these quick lube shops, Kevin. You've got to really be careful what oil you're putting in and what oil filter you're putting in. You know, Bounty, the quicker picker upper, the paper that we use, that's a real good quality paper towel. The same thing holds true in oil filters. You have really cheap, oil filters, and you have Bounty oil filter. And as far as engine oil, you can buy engine oil at all kinds of levels, all kinds of prices. As long as there's a Starburst logo on it and it meets your particular engine needs, you're all set no matter what brand it is.
He is Junior D'Amato. He is not an auto expert for nothing. He's got many years under his belt. He is ASE certified, and we appreciate having him on here. We got to find a way to eventually one day get him his own radio program, get him back on the airwaves. Like he was back in the day on, when I was privileged enough to work with him at the 1460, now known as WBMS, but previously known as WBET. So, Junior, take care. You and Miss Carla and the kiddies, I hope all is well.
You too, and you back to you and your wife, and you enjoy, and thanks again for having us on, and happy WABT Day.
All right, we are going to step aside. That's all the time that we have this evening. Until next week at 6:15 p.m., have yourself a great night.